Hello, Kimara Hasev. Welcome to part three of our new, smaller, more economically friendly sized podcast format. We are plastic free and fully reusable. Part one and part two can be found on our website, and it's also available for free to download on iTunes. Wee bite-sized chunks, like the size I'm guessing Ross Thompson is probably spewing about now. Our royal correspondent, Prick Nobinson, can tell you a thing or two about five-hour drinking sessions. That's usually just his breakfast. Check out his article at leftungagged.org. You will find loads of other stuff and much more sensible people there too. You can also find a link on how to give us some spare change. A wee tip jar. If you like what we do, bung us a quid, please. On this instalment, for the theme based around the Karl Liebknecht quote, the basic law of capitalism is you or I, not both you and I, we have contributions from Laura, with a hodgepodge of thoughts surrounding the Brexit and American healthcare systems. We've got Fod, who talks about sex-selective abortions in the South Caucasus and around the world. We've got Emma with an update on what is currently happening at the Scottish Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. Yas, nae nukes, bairns not bombs, flowers not firearms. We've got Joe with class unity, now or never. And David tells us about his own industrial collapse. We've also got some tunes for you to bop along to. I love the music on Ungagged. We've got Dream Nails, Chirp Degree Burns. We've got Joe Solo and Solidarity. We've got Rob Johnson and the memory and the name of Grenfell Tower. We've got She Makes War with Devastate Me. And The Menstrual Cramps with Boys Will Be Boys. Please get in touch with us. Let us know what you think of the new format, if you agree or disagree with anything any of our amazing contributors have said. Maybe you want to tell us about a band you like. Contact us at _ungagged on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook in the usual way. Just, you know, put Ungagged in the search bar. I mean, you can do it if you want. Or you can go watch BBC Question Time. The choice is yours!
My name is Emma Coburn, I'm campaign worker at Scottish CND. I'm going to talk a little bit about our exhibition project that we're running right now. It's named Scotland, A Piece of History. It's a celebration of 60 years of campaigning against nuclear weapons in Scotland. Scotland, A Piece of History shares a rich heritage of the Scottish peace movement and shows the progression of nuclear weaponry from the first A-bomb to the multi-billion dollar global industry that exists today. We show how the weapons evolved, not only technologically, but also how the possessions of nuclear weapons became a symbol of strength and a status that was coveted by powerful nations. Most importantly, though, we are showing the evolution of the Scottish peace movement from a small number of interested parties into a broad network of CND branches, members, friends and affiliated groups. However, we wouldn't have been able to put this together without the funding from the Heritage Lottery Fund and the support from our volunteers and staff. The last 60 years have seen countless peace walks, demonstrations, fasts, petitions, blockades and rallies. Many activists have written and published articles, books and poetry about the nuclear issue in Scotland. A countless number have spent time behind bars for taking direct action against nuclear weapons. Scottish CND have been instrumental in the formation of several direct action camps, most notably the Faslane Peace Camp, which has been manned constantly with at least one anti-nuclear campaigner since 1982. Most recently, our partner organisation NukeWatch had representatives appearing in the Scottish Parliament as part of their sustained effort to expose and resolve issues around nuclear warhead convoys. We have seen Peace Education Scotland, our educational branch, which recently received charity status, visiting schools across the country and educating young people on the dangers of nuclear weapons, as well as running the Peace Campaigning Academy, a weekend residential on campaigning skills last summer. We've been pretty busy, to say the least. The exhibition opens with a section named The Facts, and we wanted to give people base knowledge before we move through the rest of the project. We now have 9 countries that have nuclear weapons, and the majority of the public are not aware that there are still 15,000 warheads in the world, and over 1,800 of them are deployed and ready to kill tens of millions of people at any moment. That is why this exhibition is so important. Nuclear weapons are often justified in terms of defence strategies and global power plays, while phrasing such as nuclear deterrent and umbrella allows politicians to distance themselves from the harsh realities that they voted for powerful and indiscriminate bombs that would inevitably incinerate millions of innocent people. This language is used to prevent everyday people from being in the loop, so to speak, on what's happening and allows those in support of nuclear weaponry to stay ahead. We're trying to change that narrative with this exhibition. One characteristic that has always distinguished Scottish CND is the way that we can and have always worked in coalition with other organisations to protest and campaign. Coalition building is no new feat, but rather has been a part of our identity from the beginning. Currently, we are involved in several networks running today. We are part of the Scrap Trident Coalition, which was instrumental in mobilising people in the run-up to the 2014 Scottish Independence Referendum and the 2016 Trident Renewal Vote at Westminster. We're Secretary of the Scottish Parliament cross-party group on nuclear disarmament, as well as being part of the Scottish Nuclear Free Local Authorities. There's another section that focuses on the depleting number of warheads over the last 60 years. Thanks to agreements like the INF, which has been in the mainstream media at the moment, thanks to Donald Trump withdrawal, and the destructive capabilities of these warheads is far greater than those that were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, up to 3,000 times more powerful. As you've heard, we've been extremely busy over the last 60 years and we could always use your support, which is the main aim of this exhibition, to give everyone a space in the peace movement. I started as a volunteer at festivals nearly 5 years ago and I often got one of two responses. Either, oh my goodness, I was a member decades ago, I didn't know you guys were still going, or aren't you a bit young to be involved in a campaign like this? I usually have a laugh with them, but then tell them that we're in a period of nuclear instability in our world not seen since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And if this isn't a time for everyone to campaign for peace, then when is? We would love if everyone who believes in peace in our world became a member and financially supported our campaign, but if that's not possible, you could volunteer your time. We always have a million and one things going on. There's space in the office to help with the everyday running of the campaign, which includes archiving material, to attending street stalls and vigils, to helping out with our social media campaigns, and attending Scotland's biggest festivals every summer. There's space for everyone. Another way many of our members and supporters get involved is by joining their local group. We have branches across Scotland and the work they do is second to none. Reaching out to people in their communities and spreading the message for a nuclear-free Scotland. We have groups from Aberdeen to Dumfries and you can find local contacts on our website www.banthebomb.org. But if getting involved with a group is too big a responsibility, there's also things you can do in your everyday life to support disarmament. We're involved with a group called Don't Bank on the Bomb, who apply pressure on large financial institutions to divest their money from the nuclear weapons industry. Moving your own financial arrangements away from such institutions and encouraging other people and organisations to do the same can make a difference. This year at AGM, we reaffirmed our support for the Faslane Peace Camp, a continuous protest against the operations at Faslane. There's a weekly vigil on Wednesdays outside the Northgate that everyone is welcome to attend, and they're always looking for donations of materials and financial support to keep the camp operating as a visual reminder of the long opposition to Trident. I think it's important to remember why we're here campaigning 60 years later. It's estimated that of a population of 350,000 people, close to half died as a result of the bombing of Hiroshima, with a further 100,000 lives ended in Nagasaki. The true consequences were censored and kept from public view by the US, and everything related was treated as a military secret. For many years, the world, including those in Japan, believed that the conventional explosives were used because that was the information that was released. They suppressed all details of what they called the atomic plague. We now know that radiation released by atomic bombs manifested in terrible cancers that not only deteriorate and torture the bodies of their victims, but generation after generation of their offspring. We know now that there are children growing up in a different century to the bombings who were victims of it. We know the scale of mental and emotional trauma faced by those who experienced the bombs is just as severe as the effects on their physical health. The nuclear weapons deployed today are many thousands of times more destructive than the weapons used at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A nuclear strike today would cause an unprecedented level of human death and suffering, and we do not have the luxury of ignorance about this issue. We must condemn the use of nuclear weapons, we must condemn the faulty logic and the rhetoric of the nuclear deterrent. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. The human race will not survive another nuclear attack. We must honour the victims of nuclear weapons at Hiroshima, Nagasaki and across the world where people have been affected by nuclear testing. To find out any more information about the exhibition project Scotland, a Piece of History, you can visit www.banthebomb.org/history or contact scnd@banthebomb.org.
Around lads, or is it sod you, Jack? 'Cause your pittance's a profit. Would you stab us in the back? One out, all our wins it, and it's all our jobs you save. 'Cause you're not just digging coal here, you're digging your own grave. Show some solidarity, show some solidarity, show some solidarity. We win, we car around, lads, it's not how it should be. What happens to my brother? Well, it happens to me. One out, all out wins it. And I'll ask you one more time, come out now and join us, and don't cross this picket line. Show some solidarity, show some solidarity, show some solidarity. And we win, show some solidarity, show some solidarity, show some solidarity. We win, we win. show some solidarity, show some solidarity, and we win, we win.
The basic law of capitalism is you or I, not you and I. Carl Liebknecht. Those words have never rung truer than today. Brexit is basically a choice between two versions of capitalism, and no matter how this torrid situation's eventually settled, a massive swathe of the population will hate it and resent those who facilitated this outcome. There's no way to win. It's divide and rule politics at its most extreme, because it splits the UK roughly straight down the middle and sets one half against the other however it plays out. This has always been my concern. I'm long past caring how you voted or why. I've had enough of listening to the bigots ranting about immigration, just as much as I've had enough of listening to those with EU stars in their eyes, seemingly in denial that said institution represents a status quo that so many felt let down by and left behind by and opted instead to destroy. I'm done with the Marxist argument of destroying bourgeois power structures as much as I am the Blairite argument that somehow the poor deluded population didn't know what it was doing and somehow would if it had another go. I'm done with it all because it's dividing us and allowing the very people who brought us to this brink to wriggle off the hook and get away with it. Anyone noticed how much worse this island is since the EU referendum debate started? How much more homelessness there is? How much in-work poverty there is? How public services have been strangled to death? How minorities are being attacked in the street? How benefit cuts and sanctions are crippling parts of our communities? How it's now possible to have three or four of Theresa May's jobs, work fewer hours than you would if you had a paper round, and be classed as in full-time employment for government statistics? Or how schools have been deliberately failed so they can be turned into academies, then starved of funds by umbrella organisations paying themselves fat salaries before they hand out budgets. The list goes on. And it's been allowed to go on because we're too busy fighting amongst ourselves to do anything about it. I've had enough. I care about one thing and one thing only, and that is class unity. If we don't have that, we have nothing at all, because only our numbers make us strong. Carl Liebknecht found that out to his peril in 1919, and ultimately it killed him. It's unite or die. Because trust me, the class war is still going on, and from where I'm standing, one side is winning because the other is more concerned with fighting itself. We are being crushed by a choice between two versions of capitalism, and all we are choosing is the colour of our chains.
Believe it, though the life through their teeth. I hope everyone's holidays were good. Mine was okay. This year was my 5th Christmas in a row without my family, and I've gotten used to it. Though it was a bit sadder this year. I think it's because the last 2 years, at least I was in London, so able to celebrate with pretty streetlights and whatnot. But now I live in China, thanks to the UK's hostile environment, and they obviously don't celebrate Christmas here. As a side note, I've been in China for 4 months now, and, well, I'm not tremendously enjoying my time. Seriously, I have a distinction-earning master's degree in European Union studies focused mostly on immigration and British politics. If anyone listening knows of a company that can hire a non-EU immigrant and needs somebody with this background, please reach out. And I'll go anywhere in Europe, I don't mind. I don't hate Romania nearly as much as your island seems to. I just need to be able to use my brain again instead of just teaching toddlers their colors. Please help save me from this. Anyways, okay, now on to complaining about capitalism, which is slightly ironic after I just begged for a job, but hey, here we go. Once I no longer live in China, by the way, I will have several more stories about this topic to add to my repertoire, but for now, I don't really want to say anything critical about this place until I no longer live under this government. I'm sure you understand, but trust me, this place is fascinating. Instead, let me touch on a subject that I have already discussed here on Ungagged back in the Krasavi episode from last September. Or Krasivi? Krasavi? I never did figure out how to pronounce it. But either way, on that episode, I discussed my experience as an American using the NHS. On the one hand, the idea that a visit to A&E, numerous blood tests, 2 ultrasounds, and ultimately a surgery and a night in the hospital, was all free, was absolutely incredible. On the other hand, I went to A&E in mid-April, had to wait for a follow-up GP appointment for 7 weeks, waited another 3 weeks for an ultrasound, waited another 6 weeks for another ultrasound, but that's normal, then waited another month for a follow-up, and then was told to wait 6 months for a surgery. Now, if you're counting, 6 months is about 24 weeks, 6 weeks longer than the promised 18-week threshold for surgeries. And what I needed done was not a knee replacement or a bunion fixed, I had an orange-sized cyst on my ovary. And I fought like hell for them to move up the surgery, which they did, to 12 weeks wait. So I fought, they moved it up by 12 weeks, by half, and after the surgery, they told me that I would have lost my ovary had the original surgery not been moved. They said that they were surprised my ovary had held up as long as it had, and it ended up being a longer surgery than intended because of it. So if I hadn't fought, I would actually be missing an organ right now. This is what cuts to the NHS have done. And it's not merely cuts. I was absolutely shocked when I found out how low a GP's salary is, starting around £27,000. In America, a starting doctor makes the equivalent of around £70,000. I cannot imagine going through the medical training in order to make a salary that low. No wonder the UK struggles to train its own citizens in medicine. I sure as hell wouldn't go through such an intense studies in order to have one of the most stressful jobs for that low of a salary. The UK pays medical professionals poorly. While university fees climb, of course not enough people are choosing this career. As such, the NHS must look elsewhere for talent. Currently, 12.5% of all NHS staff are foreign-born, with about half of those being EU citizens, so good luck after Brexit. And as I have mentioned in many an ungagged contribution, Theresa May and her cronies make it excruciatingly difficult for non-EU folks to come. This includes doctors who do not qualify for the minimum £30,000 salary that is required of all non-EU workers. In addition, only about 20,000 non-EU immigrants are issued work visas every year. Yes, you heard that correctly. We all might be coming for your jobs. All 20,000 of us. And those 20,000 are spread out over every industry. Studies have shown that the NHS would have nearly 5,000 more doctors every year if this cap didn't exist. And currently, only 1,500 doctors can come, and that's only on a 2-year visa that is very expensive to re-up. Currently, the NHS in England alone is short nearly 10,000 doctors, of which they would have if not for the draconian immigration policies against non-EU immigrants. But back to the actual theme of today, capitalism. That is about you or I, not you and I. And as an American, for as stressed out as I was about those wait times, I was and still am very grateful for the lack of cost. I paid my NHS fee with my non-EU visa, and through that I was able to save my ovary. Even though I nearly lost it, but, you know, let's glaze over that. But in America, I have to be careful who I tell this whole story to. Because we are told that a universal health system means exactly what happened to me. It means jeopardizing your health through these long wait times. And if I tell even a hint of my tale to Republicans, they take it and kind of run with it. So I don't. But at the same time, when I tell my liberal friends who desperately want a universal system, they sometimes end up telling me that I'm mostly making it up, because they think that those wait times are just Fox News propaganda. I've learned to tell the tale with an emphasis on, it's because of government cuts, and that seems to suddenly allow them to believe that these wait times actually exist. Now, I'm not one to mind throwing the Tories under the bus. I hate them. I hate them a lot. But I shouldn't have to preface my story with that. Witnesses to a situation should be believed over partisan politics, and it kind of goes to show the state of the world we live in that they know how liberal I am, and they know I experienced this firsthand, and their initial reaction is to still disagree with me simply because it goes against their own narrative. But it's a tale of caution, I suppose. Remember that all things have flaws, and that in order to make sure a policy is better, you must first accept those flaws. Pretending the wait times don't exist aren't exactly going to help us create a good system when the time finally comes for America. Hashtag go millennials. Anyways, I was incredibly stressed during this waiting saga. I was concerned for my health, yes, but more so I was concerned about my bank account. See, because of the wait time, I was initially told a surgery date that was a month after my visa was set to expire. After much harassment, I was able to get them to move up the date by nearly 3 months. However, 2 days before the surgery was set to occur, I came down with a cold that was accompanied with quite the cough. When I arrived at the hospital, I was promptly told that you can't have surgery if you have a cough. So they canceled it, told me it would probably be another long wait, and I called my father in America at 2 a.m. his time, absolutely sobbing as I walked back from the hospital. Cue more harassing phone calls, and I was finally able to have the surgery 2 months before my visa expired. So I was concerned about my health, yes, but the reason for the hysterical phone call to my father wasn't because I was worried about the surgery, it was because if I was sent back to America without it, I literally would not be able to have it. My home country wouldn't provide me with an organ-saving operation, because our healthcare system cares more about money than patients. I was a 28-year-old unemployed person. I was 2 years too old for my parents to cover me, and too poor to do it on my own, and because I was unemployed, I'm probably deemed not worthy of it. To get insurance in America, most people go through their employer. I did not have one. And because America is too capitalist for its own good, we care more about filling the pockets of the insurance companies than we do about helping people, and the hangover from the Cold War, which ended when I was a baby, still scares people away from a universal system because it is seen as being too close to communism. Even though every other developed country has a universal system, and we know that France isn't communist, but whatever. And as another holdover from a past era, Reagan was last president when I was in the womb, and yet people still believe in trickle-down economics. Because apparently, if we pay the insurance companies money, surely they will spend that wealth and help the uninsured in West Virginia. Okay. Now, as I mentioned in the Crassavy episode, the American healthcare system is not as horrible as it initially seems. After all, there are reasons, other than just communism, that the American public is hesitant to trade the current system for the universal one. For example, I come from an upper-middle-class background. When I compare my experience of the NHS with my experience in the American healthcare system as an upper-middle-class person growing up, I would choose America any day. It took me nearly a year for a necessary surgery in England, whereas in America I'd have had to wait at most 3 months. And while most insurance companies don't cover 100% of a bill, like the NHS does, I would still gladly have paid $200 to have not dealt with the stress of the wait times back when I was still on my parents' insurance. But last year, I didn't have $200, and it wouldn't have mattered if I did, because $200 is what somebody with insurance would pay. I didn't have insurance and would have had to pay out of pocket, which probably would have been a minimum $15,000. So are you beginning to understand why I was panicking when they sent me away because of a cough? So the American system is great for people who can afford it, which, by the way, is most Americans, around 3/4 of us. But that does leave 25% with either no or inadequate care. And in a country as large as America, that's 80 million people, or the combined populations of the UK, Ireland, and Sweden. But even with 80 million facing difficulty, that's still 250 million who would see their healthcare take a hit if we switch to what the NHS currently is. In addition, the 250 million with insurance are more likely to be voters than the 80 without, as the more stable one's life is, the more likely one is to participate in society. Not to mention the fact that poor people of color are often disenfranchised from voting anyways, which I have discussed back in the People Spoke episode last summer. So between the power that insurance companies hold in Congress, combined with the fact that liberals are so insistent on getting universal system that they pretend that wait times aren't actually a problem, so they're not going to learn from the faults of other systems, and combined with the fact that most Americans like the current system, and we've got one hell of an uphill battle. I think it can be done in my lifetime, as my generation is on the rise and we support the idea of a universal healthcare system. America did just have our midterm elections a couple of months ago, and 48 new lawmakers campaigned on the platform of a universal system. Only 30% of Americans are in favor of a complete universal system, but 60% do say that the government should provide more than it does. So, you know, we're getting there. We're getting there. Both systems are flawed. You know, when I was going through the NHS, I should have been purely concerned about my health, but instead that was a back burner issue, as between British austerity and immigration policies on the one hand, and the American healthcare system and capitalism on the other, those stresses really took a toll. I know another American who is currently studying in the UK who was recently diagnosed with cancer, so she's going through the same stress except on a much worse level. Because of her treatments, which are in their own obviously very terrifying, the Home Office is threatening to deport her, because she is missing too many classes to be legally considered a student. And if you think that they would make an exception to the rules for cancer, you clearly haven't been paying any attention to what the Home Office does. And she doesn't have any insurance in America. She would literally die if she was sent away from the NHS, because she wouldn't be able to get the treatment in America. Because she quit her job so that she could get a PhD in England. And then she got cancer. Speaking of, let's go down another rabbit hole involving the NHS and immigration, shall we? Because, well, there's just so many rabbit holes we can do in that. Like I've said, I paid an NHS fee when I applied for my visa. All non-EU immigrants have to pay this fee. It's called the NHS surcharge. When I paid it, it was about £200, and I didn't mind paying it, as I was a student and thus not paying taxes. Now, I did still pay twice as much in tuition fees as did my British and EU comrades, as well as paid for an expensive apartment, frequented local establishments, yada yada yada. In total, I poured about £20,000 into the British economy in the 17 months the Tories oh so graciously allowed me to live there. But since technically none of that was tax, fine, I'll pay the fee and not complain about it. Especially when I got a surgery out of it. However, even non-EU immigrants who are on work visas have to pay this fee. And that's where the morality of the surcharge becomes a bit dicier. Because they already pay taxes, why do they have to pay an extra fee simply because they're foreign? And just a couple of weeks ago, this fee doubled. So now non-EU immigrants are paying even more to pay for a service that they already pay into. It's now £400 a person, so for a family of five, that's an extra £2,000 a year that they have to pay when mom and dad are already paying taxes. It's labeled as an NHS fee, but in reality, it's a foreigner fee. And as I highlighted in the last Ungagged episode, the outcry over the £65 fee for EU citizens to apply for settled status is important, make sure to have outcry over that. It's atrocious that the Tories would make people pay to stay in their homes. But also, the doubling of an already dubious fee for non-EU immigrants has been met with complete silence from the British public. So please use your voice to support both European and non-European immigrants. The latter especially has to pay thousands of pounds in order to pay for Home Office fees, plus these fees, plus all sorts of other things. Please help fight to bring an end to the injustice instead of merely celebrating when a 65 quid fee for Europeans is waived. Thank you. This is a song for the heavy-hearted. Lost friends and the dear departed.
Today I'm going to talk about gendercide in the South Caucasus region. The practice of aborting female fetuses is found mostly in China and other Asian countries, but it's prevalent in the Caucasus too. Across South Caucasus countries, many parents to be prefer male children and baby girls come as a disappointment. If nature takes its course, 107 boys are born for every 100 girls. Boys are more vulnerable to childhood diseases, so a slight preponderance of them at birth ensures equal numbers at puberty. But in Azerbaijan, more than 114 boys are born for every 100 girls. In Armenia, the figure is 112, and in Georgia, the ratio is 106. These are bigger distortions than in India. In all three, the figure has risen sharply since 1991. There is even names for unwanted girls in these regions. In Azerbaijan, you might see girls named Kifayat Yeter, which means enough. In Armenia, the name Bavakan. in Dagestan, Kistaman. The trend has sparked warnings of a future gender imbalance in the region, which will make it harder for men to find partners. As elsewhere, cheap ultrasound machines which can detect the sex of the fetus made a difference. Before the collapse of Soviet Union, such machines were rare because parts had military use and their exports from the West was banned. As they spread after 1991, sex-selective abortions rose. Yet such machines also became more common in Ukraine and other nearby countries where sex ratios stayed stable. They rose in North Ossetia, part of the Russian Caucasus, and also in parts of Turkey, but only 207. What explains the Caucasus exception? The answer may be political. A preference for sons could be as strong because all three countries have frozen conflicts, which might greatly diminish women's bargaining powers, such as that man's preference for sons determines family planning. If so, that would be a remarkable reversal. In the 1970s of the Soviet Union, boasted that women there had more rights than their sisters elsewhere, and the Soviet state suppressed religious discrimination against women. Some preference in the Caucasus suggests the traditional values are reviving. An imbalanced birth sex ratio has been present in the 21st century in the West Balkans too, in countries such as Albania, Macedonia, Kosovo, and Montenegro. As of 2016, according to CIA estimates, Albania has one of the highest birth sex imbalances in the world, at 110. Many scholars and experts claim that sex-selective abortions are becoming common in Southeast Europe. The reason for intensifying sex-selective abortion in China and India can be seen through history and cultural background. Male babies were preferred because they provided manual labor and continuation of the family lineage. There are reports of women from Vietnam, Myanmar, and North Korea systematically trafficked to mainland China and Taiwan and sold into forced marriages. Some experts argue that as the proportion of women to men decreases globally, there will be an increase in trafficking and sex work, both forced and self-elected, as many men will be willing to do more obtain to a sexual partner.
The Minister for Profits states categorically, you can make a lot more profit without health and safety. Building rules and regulations, all that bother, all that fuss. If the worst ever happens, it won't be happening to us. And the Lord Mayor of Privilege, he will not be moved. He's closing down fire stations so the service will improve. He's restructured worse conditions, he's reorganized less pay. But if the worst ever happens, he's pretty sure he'll be okay. Screaming true blue murder. Screaming true blue murder. And the councillors of Kensington, the KCTMO, well, they like to call it property, while we just call it homes. They don't go into details like complaints and smoke alarms. But if the worst ever happens, their bank accounts will be unharmed. So when the worst ever happened on the 14th day of June, a spark on the fourth floor, all too soon, flames spread through the cladding, meant to make the town look nice. And the worst ever happened, 'cause it was cheaper half the price. Screaming true blue murder. Screaming that's what people do. Fire crews climb the burning tower, that's what fire crews do. Death toll spiraled higher, like smoke into the night. When the worst ever happened, guess who thought they'd be alright? Yeah. All the ministers of fire trap, prime ministers of greed, the councillors of millionaires and empty properties. But we took the town hall Friday. Your lies have lost their power, and we're numbering your days in the memory and the name of Grenfell Tower. And we're numbering your days in the memory and the name of Grenfell Tower. Screaming true blue murder. Screaming true blue murder. Screaming true.
Hello, this is episode 27 of my syndicated micro-podcast This Week with David Rovics. Here in the USA, the government shutdown is over for now, and the state of emergency has not yet been declared. Stay tuned for future episodes when we find out what happens in America's rapid transition to an openly fascist state. Hundreds of thousands of government workers and millions of contract workers are trying to put their lives back together. It turns out so many of them had no means to cope with missing one paycheck, despite being more or less gainfully employed, often because they're spending so much on housing that they can barely afford to keep roofs over their heads when they're not being furloughed. And they have negative savings, otherwise known as perpetually maxed out high-interest credit card debt. They are part of the growing class of Americans who no longer measure desperation by lack of savings or even by massive credit card debt, but by the point when you can no longer pay the minimum because you missed one paycheck. The stories of high-interest credit card debt, late fees, medical needs put off or ignored, unpaid bills, not knowing what lies around the corner, that point where you decide it's okay to see if folks out there in a less difficult situation might be willing to help out a bit, the fear that someone will then expose you as a fraud and a freeloader, they're all so familiar. I have personally never had what I thought might be a stable job, and I've never been furloughed from such a job either. But for most of my adult life, I've been one of many, many people working in an industry that has been in a state of perpetual collapse. I know most people don't conceptualize music as a business or as a job, but it is, or at least it used to be. The business they used to call the music industry was altogether 5 times bigger when I started working as a musician than it is now. The feeling of working in a perpetually collapsing industry is a lot like playing the classic video game Frogger, where you're leaping from one sinking log to another sinking log, hopefully departing one log before it sinks and landing on another before it does the same. It's a process of constantly trying to figure out how to stay afloat now that the whole scenario has changed yet again. Amid so many other collapsing industries, from steel mills to newspapers to big box stores, it's easy to overlook professions as marginal to begin with as songwriters, recording artists, or touring musicians. But I promise that the collapse of these professions has been across the board, left to right, top to bottom. The fact that everybody else's industries are collapsing at more or less the same time as mine is one reason this industrial collapse is an easy one to miss. Another reason is that everybody has been simultaneously transfixed by the same evolving technologies that have inundated us all with the very stuff that very few people can make a living producing anymore. Journalism, books, movies, music, etc. Occasionally, people look up from their phones or have a moment to think about those other than themselves who are failing to make ends meet, and kind of like peeking out from your tent after an all-night thunderstorm at a festival, you emerge to see that half of the tents that had been set up are now floating in mud. To briefly summarize what has taken place for people in my profession over the past century or so. From the time radio began, up until the Reagan-Clinton deregulation of the airwaves that started immediately after Reagan took power in 1981, there were all kinds of opportunities for local artists to develop a local following, to get exposure, to work in the industry. Deregulation meant the sudden loss of thousands of local radio jobs throughout the country, with the impact of the loss of those jobs on independent music incalculable. This is what paved the way for Clear Channel and the full-spectrum dominance of the culture factories in New York, L.A., and Nashville. As the phenomenon of downloading and streaming music online took off globally around the turn of the millennium, it was a great time for new people to hear your music from all kinds of corners of the world without leaving home. But in many places, such as the U.S., their cost of living was rising fast, but earnings were not, and with that combination of factors, they weren't leaving home. And when they did, they weren't buying CDs or t-shirts. The fact that crowdfunding platforms like Kickstarter started up when they did was no coincidence. These weren't new ideas. They became popular when they did, primarily because of good timing. That is, at the time they started up, many people were now sufficiently desperate to start begging. I first started crowdfunding recording projects in 2011, when so many other people did. I didn't use one of the new crowdfunding platforms, but that's also when they were all getting popular. If a musician is going to spend $12,000 in a studio making an album that no one is going to buy, it's going to take a very long time before the $20 a month in revenue the album might generate from streaming will cover that expense. It was only 2 years after Kickstarter kicked off and we all started crowdfunding album projects that it began to sink into me that not only could I not afford to record albums without crowdfunding them, but I couldn't afford to pay the rent either without making some drastic lifestyle changes, such as finding an entirely different line of work or touring 12 months a year and abandoning my children, because the loss of CD sales alone meant losing 40% of my annual income. It didn't help that in the meantime, my rent had also doubled. In this experience, I was also in very good company. I'm sure it was not coincidental that Patreon was becoming a popular platform around the time that I set up my own version of their subscription model on my own website. The desperate evolution of my own career clearly was mirrored by many other careers following the same treacherous, avalanche-prone mountain path, in the dark with bears. The business model of creating free content and then asking people to voluntarily support you in your endeavor to pay the rent while you continue to create and give away free content online is a weird, ethereal way to go about one's life, I can tell you that. And it doesn't work as well as selling albums used to. But soon, all of what I'm talking about here will seem mysterious to all of the other songwriters and bands putting music up online for free and making a few bucks a month from Spotify, who never were in a position to entertain dreams of selling thousands of CDs on tours around the world every year and supporting themselves in the process, as I did for most of my adult life. That, in a nutshell, is the story of my own industrial collapse. What's yours?
Again last night happens every time I play. When the gig is over, someone has to say a question that appears to be on everybody's brains as they're driving down the highway in the commuter lanes. It sure is not just me, it's the 99% of artists who are wondering about the thousands they just spent on a CD that will never make it to the air. Now all of us are grown-ups here. We know life is
on the radio?
Why don't they play you on the radio?
Why don't they play you on the radio?
Why don't they play you on the radio?
This has been episode 27 of This Week with David Rovix, which is available for radio stations to use for free if they want to, and can be found on iTunes, Google Play, Podbean, and all the other usual podcasting platforms, as well as on SoundCloud, YouTube, Spotify, Pacifica's audio port, on the David Rovix mobile app, and at davidrovix.com/thisweek. This podcast is made possible by your support. You can find out how to support the podcast at davidrovix.com/thisweek, or you can join my community-supported art program by going to davidrovix.com/subscribe. Hope to see you here in podcast land next week.